This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ketanji Brown Jackson was sworn in on Thursday as a U.S. Supreme Court justice, making history as the first black woman on the nation's top judicial body, while joining it at a time when its conservative majority has been guiding several major rulings. Her swearing in as U.S. President Joe Biden's replacement for retiring liberal justice Stephen Breyer came just 6 days after the court overturned the 1973 Roe v. Wade landmark that legalized abortion nationwide. Breyer, at 83, the court's oldest member, officially retired on Thursday. Jackson is the 116th justice, sixth woman, and third black person to serve on the Supreme Court since its 1789 founding. Like the three conservative justices appointed by the Democratic president Republican predecessor Donald Trump, the 51-year-old Jackson is young enough to serve for decades in the lifetime job. In a blow to the fight against climate change, the Supreme Court has limited how the nation's main anti-air pollution law can be used to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from power plants, AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
By a 6-3 vote with conservatives in the majority, the Supreme Court said that the Clean Air Act does not give the Environmental Protection Agency broad authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants that contribute to global warming. Instead, the EPA is now limited to plant-by-plant regulation. Power plants account for roughly 30% of carbon dioxide output. 19 mostly Republican-led states and coal companies led the fight against broad EPA authority to regulate carbon output. The court's ruling could complicate the administration's plans to combat climate change. Norman Hall, Washington.
This is VOA News. Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the namesake son of an ousted dictator, has been sworn in as Philippine president. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Protesters hold placards that read, "Never again to martial law" and "Reject Marcos Duterte." Activists and survivors of the martial law era say the political comeback has been pulled off by whitewashing his family's image. Marcos Jr.'s rise to power comes 36 years after an army-backed people power revolt booted his father from office. But in his inaugural speech, Marcos Jr. defended the legacy of his late father, who he said accomplished many things that were not done since the country's independence. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A new poll finds many Americans feel former President Donald Trump should be charged with a crime for his role in the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll finds 58% of those surveyed believe the former president bears a great deal or quite a bit of responsibility for the deadly attack on the Capitol, and 48% say Trump should be charged with a crime for his role. 31% of those surveyed say he should not be charged with a crime, while 20% say they don't know enough to have an opinion. The poll was conducted after the first five public hearings of the House committee investigating January 6, but before Tuesday's hearing with former Trump White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson. Experts say her testimony provided the most compelling evidence yet that Trump could be linked to a federal crime. Ben Thomas, Washington.
A Sudanese medical group says four people were killed in anti-coup rallies during which protesters denounced the country's military rulers and demanded an immediate transfer of power to civilians. The Sudan Doctors Committee said in a tweet that security forces shot and killed four people during the rally on Thursday in Omdurman, the twin city of Khartoum, the capital. Police fired tear gas at thousands of demonstrators trying to reach the Republican palace in the heart of Khartoum. Recapping our top story, Ketanji Brown Jackson was sworn in on Thursday as a U.S. Supreme Court justice, making history as the first black woman on the nation's top judicial body, while joining it at a time when its conservative majority has been guiding several major rulings. Her swearing in as U.S. President Joe Biden's replacement for retiring liberal justice Stephen Breyer comes 6 days after the court overturned the 1973 Roe v. Wade landmark that legalized abortion nationwide. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We've heard different versions of where these talks might be held, possibly in Kenya, possibly in Tanzania. And so would the leaders of those countries take a more active role?
That's Cameron Hudson with the Center for Strategic and International Studies talking about plans for peace talks between the Ethiopian government and Tigrayan leaders. Details coming up. Also, a recent round of heavy fighting in the eastern DRC has revived decades-old animosities between Kinshasa and Kigali. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The Democratic Republic of Congo today marked its Independence Day with a ceremony to bury the gold-crowned tooth of independence hero Patrice Lumumba more than 60 years after he was assassinated. Reporter Anastasi Tudishi in Kinshasa followed the ceremony and tells me what she witnessed.
So what I have witnessed is a whole country gathering around a hero, their hero, no matter what political or what walk of life, what religion people were. It really was in Kinshasa, everybody gathering and mourning and also rejoicing around the remains of Patrice Emery Lumumba. So, of course, you have the official ceremony held within the Échangeur de l'Unité, which is on the road to the airport, and that's also where the mausoleum is and the statue of Lumumba is. But outside, hundreds and hundreds of Congolese were gathered just to have an opportunity to have a glimpse, to take a glimpse at his coffin passing by. And what was really striking to me was the unity, a word that was really dear to his heart, the unity between the official speeches and the people's speeches. Everybody related to him and talked to him as someone who wanted a better DRC. I spoke with a young man who was 25 and who was jobless, and he said that the youth should be inspired by him because, no, he was 30, and he said that the youth should be inspired by him because at the moment of his death, he was 35 and he was fighting for the freedom of his country. And the youth in the DRC should be inspired by his energy and his commitment for a better DRC.
A very moving ceremony. You also got to talk to Lumumba's daughter, Juliana. Could you share some of the conversation you had with her?
We actually were lucky enough for her to have us at Patrice Lumumba's house, where she is living right now in Kinshasa. And she shared with her, I asked her what prompted her to write a letter to Belgium in 2020 to demand that the remains of her father would be, you know, restituted to the DRC. And she replied that as an African woman, an African child, you can't live a quiet life when you know that the soul of your father is not back into the country he fought so hard for. So that's what prompted her to write this letter. And she said that she wrote it with her guts and, like, you know, a daughter wanting to see her dad back. And she just sent it out there, and she didn't really know what response she would have. And she also said that she wrote that letter after her brothers, years prior, sued the Belgian government without any response. So the whole family is completely relieved, and they feel honored with all the ceremonies and the way the government has treated the remains of Patrice Lumumba.
I also talked to her son, Jean-Jacques Lumumba, last week, and there seems to be a euphoria in the family because of, you know, the return of the remains.
I asked her, and she said she immediately wanted to share it with her brothers. She said it was a group victory. It was not just hers, because her brothers started the movement, and she did her part. And of course, that probably is what brought the remains back, but it's a family fight. and it's a fight that they fought together. And so she really wanted to share it with her brothers. She made that clear. And she also shared that she was very surprised as she was accompanying her father's coffin to the mausoleum, hearing youngsters say, scream Lumumba's name and dance and chant to his name and saying that he was killed, he was assassinated, but now he's back and we're happy he's back.
That was journalist Anastasia Tudushi. She spoke to me from Kinshasa. A recent round of heavy fighting in the eastern DRC has revived decades-old animosities between Kinshasa and Kigali, with the DRC blaming neighboring Rwanda for a resurgence of a militia called M23. Rwanda has repeatedly denied backing the rebels, while both countries have accused each other of carrying out cross-border shelling. Following renewed fighting, neighboring Uganda has seen an upsurge in the number of Congolese refugees. Douglas Mpuga reached Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Henry Oryem Okello, for an update on the situation.
Well, the issue is this. Last week, on Monday, the head of state in the region had a conclave meeting in Nairobi under the leadership of President Uhuru Kenyatta, and presents were President Tshisekedi, President Kagame of Rwanda, President Museveni was there, where they discussed the next step in order to start mobilization and moving regional forces in eastern DRC in order to see how to pacify the ongoing situation. I'm glad to inform you that there's an advanced team which has already moved on the ground in eastern DRC to evaluate the situation, to evaluate the kind of forces, kind of equipment, and the kind of threats they face, and that advanced team is already on the ground. On the border with Uganda, in a place called Bunagana, where there was an incursion of M23s, I'm glad to inform you also that the Uganda People's Defense Forces have repulsed that group and that the Bunagana border is now getting back to normal. There's a lot of disruptions for about a week where people had stopped doing cross-border trade, where shops were closed for fear of ADF atrocities. But things are now getting gradually to normal.
I understand the East African community is trying to resolve this conflict, but Uganda being at the border and in close contact with most people, the refugees, is there a special role Uganda can play to resolve this conflict?
Well, Uganda is part of the conflict resolution, and Uganda is ready to deploy its forces on the ground, if permitted by the regional leaders, and to see how to help bring this process situation to an end.
Yeah, talking of regional leaders, Rwanda and DR Congo don't seem to be on the same page with accusations and counter-accusations. What's Uganda's role in putting those two countries together?
Well, what is positive is that the Monday before the start of CHOGAM in Kigali, when we had the meeting in Nairobi, whereas all the head of states of Eastern community were there, of course, except Tanzania was not there, there was an expectation amongst people from the region that President Kagame would not attend, and on the grounds that he was supposed to be welcoming head of states coming to Rwanda for the Commonwealth head of government meeting. So there was an impression that he might not attend. However, to show his seriousness and commitment to the peace process, President Kagame did attend and was there in person in Nairobi, where else he should have been in Kigali to welcome head of states. President Museveni, on the other hand, also was there to assist and be part of the process to see how to resolve the conflict that was between the two countries as of then. President Tshisekedi did arrive and was there, and President Museveni did make his contributions to the leaders and his thoughts to the leaders on how best this conflict should be resolved, including the readiness of our troops to be deployed in the region.
M23 is not the only rebel group in that region. What's the status of other rebel groups operating in that area, and what ought to be done?
Unfortunately, there are many groups, but the major one which we're dealing with and the major one which is causing us immediate threat is M23. However, the other groups who are there and also similarly are causing insecurity in the region and causing insecurity to other countries, Rwanda and the DRC. What is the problem in eastern DRC is that eastern DRC is is almost no man's land, and it is a place that has got lots of minerals that can be easily accessible by anybody. This is diamonds, this is gold, this is chalcedon, there's timber, there's anything you can think of as a mineral is there in Eastern DRC. And hence, it has made it a heaven for all the kind of negative forces who want easy access to these minerals, in which they exchange them for weapons, and then cause insecurity in the region. So there's a lot of work to be done to secure the region, because unfortunately also it's awash with all kind of minerals which are being used to fuel and finance terrorism in the region.
Henry Oryem Okello is Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. He spoke with Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. Mali's military government has adopted a timetable for staging elections just days ahead of a regional summit to consider the future of sanctions against the country. The French news agency AFP reports it has seen official documents saying presidential elections will be held in February 2024, preceded by a referendum on a revised constitution in March 2023. The documents also said local elections will be held in June 2023, followed by a legislative ballot later that year. The timetable is a key issue on the confrontation between Mali and the Economic Community of West African States. Military officers ousted Mali's elected president, Ibrahim Babacar Keita, in August 2020. Since then, neighboring countries have pushed for an early restoration of civilian rule. On January 9th, ECOWAS imposed tough trade and financial sanctions for perceived foot dragging on meeting this demand. Its leaders will meet Sunday in Ghana to decide on the future of these measures. The head of Tunisia's Constitution Committee, law professor Sadok Bouled, delivered the draft of a new constitution to President Kais Saied. The draft was written without including Tunisia's main political parties, such as the Islamist Ennahda and Free Constitutional Parties. Deans of universities refused to join the committee. The powerful UGTT labor union also refused to participate in talks for the new constitution, saying the outcome has already been decided. Khalid Chouket, former Tunisian minister for parliamentary affairs, discussed the constitutional crisis in Tunisia with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The road to this proposed new constitution is an improper and non-transparent path, as most political forces believe that there was no need in Tunisia for a new constitution, and it was possible to save time and public money by introducing amendments to some chapters in the 2014 constitution, the constitution of the Second Republic, which won the world's admiration and appreciation, as it is one of the best constitutions in the Arab region. At least this proposed new constitution did not respect the international standards adopted in terms of democracy, transparency, and integrity in its drafting. We should not forget that all respected personalities and institutions refused to participate in the committee that was formed to carry out the task of drafting it. From this point of view, the matter was a real scandal, in addition to the doubts hovering over the referendum related to this constitution, which will deepen the legitimacy crisis instead of finding a solution to it.
The draft proposes a system with a powerful president who appoints the prime minister, while under the 2014 constitution, which enjoyed broad support, as you said, the parliament had a big role and could withdraw confidence from the government. Would that mean Tunisia would change its political system from a parliamentary one to a presidential political system?
The main objective of presenting this new constitution, as announced by the supporters of President Saied, is actually to change the political system from amended parliamentary system to a presidential one, with which parliament will lose the power to form the government or withdraw confidence from it, and thus make the government a mere administration of the head of the state. There is no doubt that one of the most important weaknesses in the 2014 constitution is to make the executive authority too heated, which makes government decisions often slow and helpless. But the solution, in my opinion, cannot be a return to the situation that existed before the revolution of 2011. The presidential system is usually dangerous in the stages of democratic transition and may lead to the return of dictatorship.
With his new constitution in hand, President Kais Saied intends to put to a referendum on July 25. Though the opposition had said it will boycott the referendum, thousands of Tunisians protested against the referendum in the capital over the weekend. Could a poor participation in the upcoming referendum deem it as illegal?
Unfortunately, the electoral law issued by President Saied in the form of a decree to organize the referendum of the proposed new constitution did not specify a specific participation rate in order to say that this constitution is acceptable or not. In this case, normally we should have about 5 million voters who say yes to go on. Some countries, for example, require the participation of at least 2/3 of the electorate in order for the constitution to be representative of the majority of the people. The voters next July 25 will not reach 1 million voters, perhaps, which means that the constitution will be without real legitimacy.
That was Khalid Choket, former Tunisian Minister for Parliamentary Affairs, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. After 2 years of a war that has taken an enormous toll on both sides, the Ethiopian government and Tigrayan forces are showing willingness to come to the negotiating table. This week, the Ethiopian government named a team of 7 negotiators to participate in possible peace talks. And the Tigrayan leader, Debretsion Gebremichael, recently wrote an open letter to the international community stating his willingness to participate in peace talks as well. Cameron Hudson is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He also served as Director of Africa Affairs in the George W. Bush administration. I asked for his thoughts on a possible peace deal between the rivals.
Well, I think in this first round, the round of negotiations that has been talked about now, that really is about, you know, a permanent truce and ceasefire. It is about, you know, it is about disarming and demobilizing armies that are squared off against each other. It is about bringing down the military tension within the country so that you can then create conditions for what has been talked about as a broader kind of national dialogue.
The Ethio-Eritrea rapprochement, would that be a sticking point in the negotiations?
Well, it's a great question. And I think that, you know, what we have not seen or heard is under what circumstances or whether Eritrea would participate in any part of these talks. It's clear that President Isaias has continued to, you know, mask his role, his ongoing role inside of Tigray. And there have been very few signals from Asmara that it is interested in any kind of peace negotiations with the Tigrayans. And so there is a question as to whether or not lasting peace can really be achieved between Tigray and Addis Ababa if Eritrea is not somehow included in those talks or brought to heel in some way. I think that's a kind of an open question right now, and clearly one for negotiators. But again, Isaias has been a very recalcitrant leader, has not subjected himself to peace talks in quite a long time, and has achieved many of the goals that he laid out for himself, although not the ultimate goal of destroying the TPLF. And so there is a question as to whether or not he will continue to play a spoiler role in the country and in the region, and what, if any, response will be from central government in Ethiopia, who, as you rightly point out, signed its own peace deal with Isaias several years ago. But if that peace deal then comes at the expense of an internal peace deal within Ethiopia, then I think we could be facing additional difficulties down the road, which is why I think it's so essential that somehow Eritrea be brought into these conversations and subjected to whatever peace arrangement gets negotiated.
And how about the African Union? Special Envoy, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, has been traveling within Ethiopia in recent weeks.
Well, the government of Ethiopia has said that they would be willing and in fact expect that these negotiations would take place under the auspices of the African Union. There's, I guess, a question as to whether or not President Obasanjo would be the lead negotiator or mediator in those talks. He has thus far been, but there's been a lot of criticism of Obasanjo's role. He has been very opaque. He has not delegated well to others. And so I think there is a question as to whether he might be the right person to take this on. We've heard different versions of where these talks might be held, possibly in Kenya, possibly in Tanzania. And so would the leaders of those countries take a more active role under the auspices of the African Union in helping to facilitate these talks? These, I think, are still questions, but clearly we have to get to a place where both the Tigrayans and the Abiy government feel comfortable with both the venue and the mediator for these talks to be able to take hold. And thus far, we've only got very vague outlines of what they would be willing to accept.
Cameron Hudson is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He talked to me here in Washington. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Shogun Chong, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.05.